A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This week, I talk to military veteran and stand-up comedian, Derek Humphrey. Gets a little gruesome with the war talk, and we hear about being in the Navy right after 9/11. We hear about his upbringing in Ohio, some addiction, all kinds of interesting stuff, and what brought him to become a stand-up comedian here in New York. A very busy one, too. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. Are you a musician? Do you make videos on your phone? Are you a podcaster? Search for Future Moments on the App Store and you'll find an app that will make your life easier. All right, thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on this podcast. And there's links to the guest, and to leave a review.
Whoa, yeah. I'm impressed.
Okay, Derek Humphrey, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, so you're a veteran.
I am a veteran.
And you're also a stand-up comic.
I am a stand-up comedian.
So I've been wondering which makes you feel like you're more in combat, being on stage or being in a war zone?
Being on stage.
It does feel like a war, right? Like you versus the audience sometimes when they're not laughing.
Right, yeah, which is often. Well, the isolation of being on the stage and being alone. When I was in the military, we're all part of a unit and part of a team. You're not successful without the team.
Mm-hmm.
And stand up, you have a team, but they're all behind the scenes.
Not necessarily rooting for you.
No. Well, I mean, like the people who are in my life who help like manage and support me
in comedy.
Yeah, in comedy, but they're not on stage with me.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and up there alone, I'm the only one who's like accountable for whatever I put out there.
Yeah. Do you sometimes feel like it's you versus the audience?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When?
When they suck.
when you're doing jokes that you know work because you've done them enough, and most of the times people laugh.
Yeah, you know, I've really changed my attitude about that though. If there's a drunk heckler, then sure. I definitely, that's me versus them or a group of them or one individual. I have a problem where I really want smart audience members, and you can't necessarily pick that.
No,
like you can ask for all the smart fans in the world, but at some point in time, you have to be like, I just have whoever likes me.
You definitely don't want to do shows at LOL Comedy Club in Times Square then.
Right. I don't ever usually go over too well there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm a little too old for them, but, yeah. So sometimes in that sense, for sure. There's no real danger and stand up. There's
ego danger.
Yeah, there's ego danger. Yeah.
Well, when you get a heckler, aren't you like, yo, I'm a veteran?
No.
No, you don't pull that card.
I never play that card. I don't even talk about it on stage.
I noticed it's not in your bio.
Nah. Uh-uh.
But I've heard you talk about it on stage, which is how I knew.
Well, I've talked about it. Depending on the context of how I've had to talk about it, I'll talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's relevant to what it is that's going on in my set, I'll bring it up. Or I have like a couple of jokes nowadays where I'm starting to touch on it.
Yeah.
But overall, I really don't address it.
Did you see combat?
Yeah.
Were you carrying a gun?
No. So I was in the Navy, and I was in from 2000 to 2005. And my ship was one of the first responders to the attacks on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we were the first ship to fire missiles into Baghdad and Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Okay, so from your ship, you fired missiles
into
Baghdad.
Yeah. So I have this thing where I do now at comedy shows where the host would be like, what do you want me to bring you up with? And I'll tell them I'm from the Oscar-nominated film Lady Bird. Right, because in the movie Lady Bird, it takes place in 2003.
Yeah.
And they show news footage as, you know, to frame it, the time frame it. And they're showing a ship firing missiles off because it was the first strike into Baghdad. That was my ship.
Oh, so there was your comedy credit?
Yeah.
Bombing Baghdad?
I know, right? I just do that as a joke. It's more a joke for me than anything else. I find it amusing. And then the audience is like, I don't remember him from Lady Bird.
Okay, so I caught the years. You were in 2000.
Yeah.
So you joined in 2000. 9/11 happened 2001.
Correct.
All right, so all of a sudden you're like, whoa. You probably didn't expect to see combat when you joined.
I know, actually. Okay, so October 17th, 2000 was the first day that I actually signed on to join. And that was the day that the USS Cole got bombed.
Oh, so did you join as a reaction to that?
No, it was just purely coincidence. So this is before we had iPhones and tablets and all that sort of stuff. I think I had a pager, maybe. Uh-huh. Like, this is 2000, so it was going, you know, it was ancient times. So I was at the recruiting office, signed my name on the dotted line, went home back to my studio apartment in Ohio, and I had a voicemail or a message on my answering machine. I had a cassette tape answering machine.
Yeah.
It was my mom, and she was saying, like, you know, the USS Cole got bombed today. You can back out of this if you want. You know, we won't hold it against you. We know that tensions are running up and all that sort of thing. And I was like, no, this is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't deny its existence when you're joining the military.
Mm-hmm.
And what's ironic about it is that the day the USS Cole got bombed, the ship that rescued it and brought it back over to America was the USS Donald Cook. And that's the one I ended up getting stationed on.
USS Donald Cook?
Yeah. It was named after a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War.
Why? What made you want to join?
I wanted to get out of Ohio.
Yeah.
More than anything else, I really want to be a comedian and be in the arts, but where I come from, you don't really, it didn't seem like an option.
Where were you coming from?
Toledo, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. So
Toledo, Ohio in the 80s is like, it was, you know, right before the auto industry tanked.
Right.
But everybody worked in the factory or, mm-hmm. you know, they worked at Kmart or whatever the case may be. Or if you're lucky or... more and more people were starting to go to school, go to college. After the fact, a lot of people I went to high school with ended up going to college, but that wasn't necessarily true of our parents.
Right. So it wasn't around you, this idea of pursuing your dreams.
Right. Yeah. My mom got remarried when I was 13, 14, and my stepdad and my mom and I used to go to Chicago and go see Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really keen on the idea of doing it, but I just didn't know how you do that sort of thing.
Well, your mom took you there. She must have been in the know of somehow.
No.
It was just random.
No, it was just that they knew that I loved Saturday Night Live and they knew I loved sketch and sort of stuff. So they're like, we'll go, you know, we'll take you. We're in town. We're going to go watch Second City. It was famous.
Right. And nobody else in your middle school or high school was tuned into this idea that you can. Yeah. Isn't it amazing how one person can completely change the trajectory of your life?
Yeah.
All it would have taken was one friend in high school to be like, hey, I think I'm going to move to New York and pursue stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I know. That would have been really influential. You know, the thing is, too, is we used to go to Second City, and that's when, like, Steve Carell was there.
Right.
So I saw Steve Carell as, like, a kid, and you're sitting there, I'm looking at, like, to see where he's at now and to see where I was then. I mean, I'm not anywhere now, but
hey, you're here.
I'm here. I am. No offense. No, but I mean, like, to think that that was a viable option in life, it just didn't seem like it. And maybe it was my own insecurities and whatnot, because I grew up as like an only child and my dad wasn't around and everything. And when he was around, it was like play sports or you're gay or whatever.
Right. Sort of a macho guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was into drugs and shit like that and into fucking off. And he didn't really have any real pursuits other than heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it just never, I remember when I told him I had to go stay with him when I was like 14, cause he lived in Detroit. And I grew up in Ohio and I had to go stay with him. And he's like, what do you want to do when you're older? I'm like, I want to be on Saturday Night Live. He's like, I don't, why? He's like, I don't see that.
What do you want to be, Gilda Radner?
Right. Yeah. He was like, he was just like, I don't see it out of you at all.
You want to play with dolls and make funny faces?
Yeah. Yeah. You want to throw coffee on yourself or be Chris Farley and jump through a table.
Right.
He just was a negative influence in that regard.
Right. So now you probably see it differently, how it's more himself projecting.
Right. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. He was a real prick.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there was, and like by the time I got to high school, yeah, I had it so in my mind that if you were in like the drama club or you were in acting or things like that, it was like, you're a nerd.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I'm glad that there are, it seems that like kids today are more accepting of different ideas and different behaviors and things like that, because I would have definitely stood to benefit from something like that.
Right. And also I think with the internet, maybe you're more in tune with what possibilities are.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So there's a lot on the table right now of this conversation. Oh. There's so much, but I want to get back to the
go for it.
The Navy. So you joined in 2000, the USS Cole had just been bombed, and you're like, all right, I'm still in, right?
Yeah.
So then you're in it for not even a full year when 9/11 happened.
Right, yeah.
So but then you're then it's 2001 and we didn't declare war in Iraq till 2003, right?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was happening with you in between those?
So after the morning of 9/11, it, you know, 8 a.m, everything in the world is fine.
Yeah, tell me about this day. What's it like being in the Navy on 9/11?
We were in a place called, we were in Jamestown, Virginia, or Yorktown, Virginia, one of the two. Jamestown, Virginia, they have a weapons unload station there. So, like,
that's where you just dock and load.
Dock, yes. We had Tomahawk missiles on our ship, and we were in the process of weapons handling is like a really big deal, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, when you're put in a dock in that situation, and you start unloading weapons, all your other functions shut down. Because they want you to be as, it's almost like putting somebody under. This ship is an organism. And so you want it to be completely like almost coma-like, because you don't want anything to go off to, you know, it's dangerous. Tomahawk missile drops, you're dead.
Whoops.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. Like,
that's a big whoopsie do.
Yeah, yeah. No drinking on the job that day. And so that's also a perfect time to send your crew off for training. So most of my, one third of the crew was actually back in Norfolk, Virginia, where the ship was stationed at, and they were in training. They were at schools. They were learning how to do like different functions on the ship and enhance their careers. So the morning of 9/11, it was Tuesday, like 8:30, 9 in the morning, and we're just like cleaning. Like part of the day-to-day routine was cleaning, obviously. So we had to clean our berthing area, which is where everybody slept, and we're just like watching MTV.
Right.
You know, we're like watching Outkast videos and Nine Inch Nails videos and stuff like that. I remember it pretty vividly. And then,
hey,
yeah, no, this is like Miss Jackson. This is before, okay. Yeah, this is before the double album. And then all of a sudden, this dude Matt, he comes just barreling down the stairs and kicks open the door. He's like, change the fucking channel, change the fucking channel. And he was like a airplane just flew into the World Trade Center. And our captain, JJ Costello, he came over the what's called the 1MC, it's the ship's announcing system. And he said, we're going to general quarters. Everybody get to your battle stations. We're getting ready. We're in, with only having 2/3 of our crew, we were able to get a completely offline ship up and going and en route to off the coast of New York within 30 minutes. which is
wow. You just like lock and load and float and go.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. And then, you know, so the morning of 9/11, so we're going full bore up, up to the coast, and we're over in like the harbor over outside Jersey, New York area.
And only one plane so far.
No, the second plane had hit. The second plane had hit this time. And we beelined it. I mean, we made it up like pretty quick within a few hours because we're going full tilt, obviously, to respond to it. And we had orders that if there were any planes that were in the sky, like shoot them down.
Yes, I remember when that happened. They
grounded all the planes worldwide.
Yep.
Like all planes in the whole world are grounded because that's potentially a weapon. So if there was still a plane in the air, there was the potential to be a terrorist. It could have been a plane full of nuns, and you're like, right, you got to take it out of the sky. So
wait, was that what you were hoping for?
Yeah, I had to, you know, eradicate that Catholic guilt.
This is for all the times you spanked me.
Yeah. This is for all those CCD classes.
Did you go to Catholic school?
Yeah.
Oh man, there's so much to talk to you about.
Yeah. It gets worse. And so, so we had this orders and whatnot, and we just were in like, we just like didn't know what was happening. We didn't know if we were going to get sent to Afghanistan. We didn't know if we were, where we were going, what we were doing, if we were going to dock in New York to help with the cleanup efforts, all that sort of stuff. But in the meantime, we're sitting there and like you see an airplane, you shoot it. Mm-hmm. Now, my role was that of a firefighter. I didn't have anything to do with weapons in that regard. I did have to carry a weapon for a while. I had to carry a gun, but they took it from us. They're like, you guys don't really need these.
Right. So you're on scene, basically.
Yeah, on scene. And then after we got, you know, it really took about a half a day or, you know, like a business day for people to really figure out that was it. As far as that goes. However, to us, we were constantly patrolling the shore. So we were all up for the next 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, somewhere around there. We were all up and down the shore. We weren't able to communicate with the outside world. And we were operating on 2/3 crew. And we refused to pull back into port because other ships were so unprepared. But our captain was so prepared and was so like, he would make fun of other ships because they'd be like, oh, they got to pull into port because they can't hang.
Because they ran out of food or something.
They ran out of food. We were eating eggs and rice for like dinner.
Yeah.
Because we just were not going to leave our station sort of thing. And we took like a lot of pride in that.
And you're just patrolling for, as a defense, your role is defense, if anything.
Yeah. And so finally, like after a few weeks, could finally send out some emails to people and be like, hey, it's me, I'm okay.
Right.
You know, this is what I know, and this is what I'm allowed to tell you, and this is what you probably know. Or
how close to ground zero were you? Like, can you smell the stuff? And
you could see, I mean, you could, no, you couldn't smell anything like that. You could see, the city, you could see like things were transpiring and whatnot, but mainly we could see that through the TV feed. I was an engineer, so I had to be down in the very bottom depths of the ship, and for the most part we weren't allowed to be topside.
Topside
is like outside on the ship, like if you're outside and whatnot, just because if you're in a battle station, you need to be where you're supposed to be.
So what was the feeling like? Was everyone just like, all right, that's it, let's go get whoever did this?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you were, all we know is we were just attacked. Mm-hmm. And it's either we need to help out in response to this, or we need to go fuck someone up.
Right.
And so that sentiment was like running rampant.
So when it happened, I think we found out pretty quickly that it was mainly people from Afghanistan.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're given orders to go attack Iraq.
Well, that was years later.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Because that, you know, 2001, we weren't in Iraq until May 2003.
Right.
Yeah. So
what happened in between, right after that? I mean,
so we came back to Norfolk for, I think we were there for about a month, and then after that we went over to Europe. We were engaged in an exercise in which America was selling some of our technology to, I believe it was NATO, but specifically Norway.
Weren't people, at least on your ship, just like, what are we doing? What the hell, man? Let's like get somebody. We were just attacked.
Yeah, the sentiment was there and everybody kind of rallied together as being like, holy shit, we are Americans. We're one sort of thing. But, you know, you follow direction from the top on down. So, you know, you try to focus your energies into executing your orders.
Mm.
And you try as best you can to put that to the side. And of course you want to see something, you want to see action. You want to, it's not that you want to see action, but you want to
get revenge,
get retribution and, yeah. And you want to defend your country and you want to, you know, they hurt a citizen. They hurt citizens. They hurt your fellow countrymen. You want to avenge that, for lack of a better term.
Right. So you were able to just, you and everyone else were just kind of suppress that anger.
No, I mean, it would come out in other ways. You know, we had like a speed bag and, you know, we had weights and stuff like that. Or, you know, we were a bunch of crazy asses anyways, but anything.
You're not a macho guy. And what I'm hearing is like kind of a macho sort of scenario.
I'm 40 now, so I'm a little bit more subdued. I'm not a macho guy in that sense at all. I mean, when push comes to shove, nah. When push comes to shove, I will be.
Yeah.
You know, I got interviewed by the New York Times yesterday, and about the Louis C.K. thing, and right. I posted it online, and I had like,
because Louis C.K. made his first comeback at the Comedy Cellar. Yeah, he did like 15 minutes drop-in.
Yeah, set. He did a drop-in set,
and the audience gave him a standing ovation.
I don't know. I don't know if it was a standing ovation or not. They might have.
Okay.
I heard it didn't go well.
He didn't do well.
Well, I heard they gave him like a really huge like ovation, half standing before he, like when he was walking up on stage.
Uh-huh.
But I heard the actual jokes didn't go that well.
Right.
But regardless of that, they asked me my opinion about the whole thing. And then I gave it and I posted it or whatever the case may be. And then like, you know, I got called a cuck by a whole bunch of internet trolls and everything, and
your opinion was
that he shouldn't. They asked me if I would let him come on my show.
Right.
I said no, because I run a bar show in Brooklyn, and we do our best to book as many women comics as we can. Right. We try to have representation, and most of the women that, I mean, 99% of the women that we book or do comedy with have expressed that they would feel really uncomfortable and they don't feel that he's atoned for what it is he's done.
Right.
So I respect and stand with that sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore I'm a cuck in the eyes of a bunch of internet trolls. And like one guy, I posted something about, I mean, cause I'm not perfect. I've done some, shitty things in my life. I'm 40. Everybody has, you know, at some point. If you haven't, I think you're lying.
Right.
And I've had to make amends and atone for him. And I was like, you know, I have to thank my wife or whatever. And some guy went on my Instagram, was calling my wife a mongoloid.
Oh.
And so I tried calling him through the app. And I was like, and I sent a message. I was like, you knuckle up, son.
Right.
So I'm ready to come fuck you up.
This cuck's gonna fuck you
up.
Yeah,
no kidding. That's why I was like, you know, like in his bio, he was like a Muay Thai fighter. I'm like, you can call yourself a ninja all day. You talk about my wife like that, I'm gonna beat you to death.
Right. Okay.
That's when I get backed into a corner, or somebody like really like angers me like that or insults my wife. Like, yeah, that's when the macho comes out.
Okay, so yeah. I see it now. All right. There we are.
But I mean, like, I've lived enough in my life. Like, I know that level of masculinity isn't helpful in all situations, but when somebody comes at my wife like that, I will slip on the brass knuckles and
you have some brass knuckles, huh?
I'm kidding.
The metaphorical brass knuckles.
Yeah, I do. I wouldn't really. That's a weapon. I wouldn't use that.
Okay, so let's get back to this. So you're on the ship, right?
Sorry. Yeah,
that's all right. You're on the ship, and you have to. And then all of a sudden, 2003, Bush. George W. announces that we're going to war with Iraq.
Oh, we knew it before he announced it.
You did.
It was just, if anybody had half a brain,
You saw it coming.
You saw it coming.
Now, how did you feel about that, knowing there were no Iraqis on that flight, right?
When the moment that we launched missiles into Baghdad was the moment that I knew I was going to get out of the military.
Get out.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because the way that I would ask people on my ship, I'd say, what are we bombing these people for? They'd be like, well, that's our orders. I'm like, well, Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. Like, well, they're terrorists. I'm like, what? I'm like, do you know what a terrorist is? And through Iraq, we helped embolden them and create ISIS.
Right.
That was part of the thing that led to that. So yeah. We did worse. We destabilized that region. The person keeping Iraq in check was Saddam Hussein.
Right.
And we removed him. And you can't tell me that it wasn't in pursuit of corporate oil interest. But moreover, we're launching missiles into Baghdad. You watch them fly over the horizon. And then you can see on the news feed, we're leveling the city. Killed thousands of people.
You saw that.
Yeah.
You knew it was your missiles.
Yeah. And we killed thousands of people. I mean, between us and like a couple of other ships,
sure.
We leveled a city. We killed thousands of people.
Children, women,
and for what? And one guy, you know, I think he's gotten older, and I think he would realize how stupid it was. But he started playing Bombs Over Baghdad, the Outkast song, you know, same album from 9/11.
Damn you, Outkast!
Yeah, I know, you're so pervasive in my life. I think Andre. Well, the thing was, is Bombs Over Baghdad is an anti-war song. It was about right. The first Iraq War. It was like. Is like you don't pull that thing out unless you plan to bang. That's like that's gangbanger shit. Because like when you pull a gun on somebody, and you don't pull the trigger, they're gonna come back at you,
right.
And they're gonna fuck you up. And so, it like we did a huge show of force in Iraq the first time. That's part of what made Osama bin Laden motivated to attack us on 9/11.
An endless cycle of revenge.
Right. And now we're right. And now we just went and leveled everything. And then it's ISIS. And now it's like it's the world's still fucked up.
It's kind of like Star Wars for terrorists. You know, like all the bombing in 2003. Now those kids that were living with the bombing, seeing their parents get killed, their grandparents get killed. They grow up.
Yeah.
And now they're 15 years old.
Yeah.
Starting to join ISIS.
Yeah. They hate us.
Hate us, and rightfully so, because that's what they grew up with.
Right. And
Americans are killing my family.
Yeah, that's what they see. And just even in that moment, I'm like, this is insane. I can't believe that everybody is so complicit and so eager to. Now, we all had to follow orders.
Right.
You follow. If you don't follow an order, you're breaking a law. And especially,
which is a tricky road to travel because, you know, World War II.
What do you mean?
World War II, the Nazis were just following orders.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, true. There's a little bit more nuance to it than that. But like in terms of how it related to us and to me, I didn't pull any triggers. I didn't push any buttons. My role there was to actually ensure everyone's safety.
I'm not casting any blame on you.
No.
I'm just saying I'm very sensitive to that. Excuse of like, oh, well, I was just following orders.
Right. And as you should be. No, for sure. And I'd like to think that in that instance, as bad as that was, it wasn't quite on par with, you know, what went on during World War II.
Of course not.
Right, right. Because I already feel bad enough. And a lot of
why because you won't let Louis C.K. perform on your bar.
yeah. You hear that, Louis? I'm calling you out. No, it's just I'm very sensitive about like even my role in it, and when people have like called it into question or belittled me for it or said whatever, it's like I already feel bad enough. Like I have a more moral PTSD.
Uh-huh.
Than I do like having guns shoved in my face or
you think about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a long time after we had done that I would just have nightmares about just rooms full of dead children. And I mean, like, not to bum everybody out who's listening, but it's just true. And so that that definitely encouraged me to get out.
Right.
Yeah. Cause I was at the point where I really enjoyed being in the military to some extent. I enjoyed being in the Navy.
Yeah.
I love being out on the water. I love sailing. I loved going to new countries. And if I, you know, if I had 20 years to spend on a boat, I would have done it. Traveling the world and seeing new things. And I
mean, you could be a cruise ship comedian. Bring it all together.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, but I've had people who've tried to reconcile the whole situation with me and tell me that what we ended up doing was ultimately for the best or whatever the case may be, but I still don't entirely feel that way.
So when you decided at that moment in 2003, after mm-hmm. the bomb went to Baghdad, that you wanted to get out, you obviously realized there was a rift between you and some of your other mates.
Some of them, yeah. I think.
So did you have to keep quiet?
No.
You didn't keep quiet?
No, we fought all the time.
You fought with your...
Yeah, some people were on my side for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned after a while to just let go, because a guy like, I'm not going to change it by myself. I used to be pen pals or email buddies, I guess at this point, with Henry Rollins.
Ah.
And I would write him and ask him advice.
While you were on the ship?
While I was on the ship, and he would tell me, and he was like, get out, man.
He would write you back?
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, I met him before I joined the Navy. I met him in 1999. He was touring with his band. It was the second or it was the third iteration of Rollins' band. The very first show that he kicked off was in Toledo at Frankie's Inner City. And he's the type of guy, he'll talk to anybody. He wants to talk to people. And I talked to him, and he was one. He's like, you got to get out of this town. I was like, I got to get out of this town. And he's like, move, idiot. He's like, go. Just get out.
Right.
You know,
and you took it too literally. Where
I took it super literally. I was like, yeah, I threw my beer down. I was like, let's get out of here, guys. And so I would write him about the sort of stuff. And he was like, yeah, you're not going to affect any change from inside the system like that, man. He's like, you got to get out.
So how do you get out? Weren't you bound to do a certain amount of years?
Yeah. So I was originally supposed to get out in early 2005. But they actually, it was in 2004. I was supposed to get out. I was supposed to get out Thanksgiving 2004. The problem was I was really, really good at my job, and I had a lot of responsibility. I was an engineer, and I was also an EMT, a firefighter. When all the anthrax attacks were happening, I was trained at how to respond to that. I was inoculated with anthrax. I had a higher level of security and stuff like that. So I was supposed to get out Thanksgiving.
What do you mean you were inoculated with anthrax?
In order to be in the presence of anthrax, I had to be inoculated. Like, I had to have anthrax shot into my body.
Whoa. So you could become immune to it.
Yeah, you're not immune, but it gives you a little bit more immunity. You're never like fully immune to it. Yeah, like nobody could throw anthrax in my face, and I'd be like, I wouldn't sneeze my way through it or anything, but like, I would definitely get sick.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, so, and like, you get sick when you get inoculated with it.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
So it's pretty brave of you to agree to that. Did you have a choice?
I did have a choice, actually. Yeah. No, I agreed to do it. I mean, I didn't want to see Tom Brokaw or Tom Daschle or any of these people. I didn't think, like, no matter what's going on with our country, you still can't send anthrax to my people.
Right. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, and I was just too important to the functions of the ship. So I remember it was getting to be around Thanksgiving time, and I was cleaning up the hallways or whatever, our usual daily routine. And our senior enlisted officer came by, and he was like, Humphrey, when are you supposed to get out? And I was like, Thanksgiving. And he's like, I don't think so.
Can they just keep you against your will?
Well, it's not, see, when you sign on to join the military, you actually sign on for 8 years. You sign 4 years of active duty service. You sign 4 years of inactive reserve. And they have, during any point in time, if, like, especially during a war or time of war,
call you back.
They can either call you back or they can just not let you go. And so they just didn't let me go. I worked out a deal with them, though, too, because they wanted me to go back and then go back overseas and go back over to the Persian Gulf. and I wouldn't go. I was starting to really show off my attitude mm-hmm. at that point. I used to do a lot of like really dumb things to just get attention and to just let people know like I'm not happy here anymore.
You were actively against the war.
Yeah, I was pretty, yeah. I was against a lot of things that we were doing. And so they wanted me to go back to it. And I was like, I was like, you guys don't want to take me back over there. I'm not going to be in a good mood. And I'm already kind of a pain in the ass. And I know you need me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to help you get ready to go. Mm. And then you can let me go. And that's what they agreed to.
What year did you get out?
2005. I got out June 2005. Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Go back to Toledo?
Fuck no.
Nah. Yeah. Where do you go from there?
I went to Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, why?
Yeah. Charleston's like the most beautiful. Well, it used to be. I think it's getting too overgrown. It used to be the most beautiful city in America. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that city would be now, but it's still fantastic. It's still really beautiful.
What brought you there?
My family.
Oh, your family?
Yeah, was... yeah. I grew up in Toledo. My parents, my stepfather, my mother, and my little brothers, who are 20 years younger than me, they moved down to Charleston when I was like 19. I got kicked out at 18, so I was like already on my own.
In Toledo?
Yeah.
You were living with your mom?
Until I was like 18, they kicked me out.
She kicked you out of the house?
Yeah.
Why?
I was a dickhead.
Yeah? Rebellious?
Yeah, I just wanted to drink and smoke and fuck off and go to concerts and just be a degenerate. And she was pregnant at the time. And she was like, you're not going to be living like this around my children.
How old was your mom when she had you?
My mom was 22 when she had me.
Yeah, young.
Yeah, she was 22 when she had me. And then she was 41 when she had my brothers.
Wow.
Yeah. Impressive. So she kicked me out. Like, I think she was 40 when she kicked me out.
Did you finish high school?
Barely. Yeah. I mean, I had gotten my diploma in the mail by that point, and I was actually, I think I was like a couple weeks into my freshman year at college. I was going to Bowling Green State University and I was living with them and they were like, you got to go. And so I ended up having to just go be on my own at that point. And I didn't last too much longer in college after that.
Did you ever finish?
No, I went back on my own. I went back to night school. I was like welding during the day and doing, blue collar labor, and I was putting myself through school. I was doing really well, actually. I was doing much better on my own because I had to pay for it and I had to do things that I was actually interested in versus what people expected of me.
Yeah.
But I just got so tired of Ohio. I grew up there. I was around the same people my whole life and I just wanted to get the fuck out.
When you came from the Navy and moved back to Charleston, South Carolina, mm-hmm. did your mom see you differently? Did you feel differently?
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't always positive though. I changed a lot during the military because I you get institutionalized and some things I still agree with.
Institutionalized in the way where you get a lot of discipline.
Yeah.
Not like a mental asylum institution.
Yeah. 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 Right? Yeah. I would, picked up a lot more like quote unquote military traits or things like that, mm-hmm. or exhibited that sort of hoorah sort of shit. And so it took me a long time to like deprogram from that as well.
And what do you mean by that? Like patriotism?
No, a little bit more patriotic, but also more of a disciplinarian and more of like kind of the machismo.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of thing. And I've spent so much time being gone. My motivation for moving down there was to be close to my family. And at certain points of time, like I wasn't very much fun to be around, believe it or not.
Why? Just too macho? Were you more closed-minded than you are now?
Probably so. Probably more closed-minded. I treated my brothers more like they were my kids, like they needed to have like a stronger male presence.
Well, they're so much younger than you, right?
Right. Yeah. But how I went about doing it, I mean, is not the way that you should.
You were more forceful, macho.
Yeah. It. Yeah. Yeah. And expected more discipline out of the kids than they're kids. They shouldn't, sort of thing. And, I mean, nothing bad. It's not like I was like a abusive or anything of that nature, you know, but it was just like, you call people, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Like my brother got in the habit of calling me dude. I was like, I'm not your dude. You know, you call me sir. Cause I want them to learn that. And that also came though, but I come from, my father was never around, my real father, but my grandfathers were. One of my grandfathers was a World War II veteran. The other one, by the time he was, I'm 40. By the time he was 40, he already had his, I think at least one or two grandkids. And he had five kids of his own. He had been married for 24 years. Like he was lived a full life.
Right.
And he, you know, Catholic, and you give respect, you show respect, all that
older generation.
Yeah. I kind of miss that sometimes too, because I, you know, after he died, some elements of things in my family kind of fell off a little bit. And I think that I'm open-minded enough to new ideas and looking at new things and having new perspectives on things. But I don't think that we should completely throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
In regards to certain,
you feel like we're missing sort of some respect for elders kind of thing.
Yeah. Or just respect for each other.
Mm.
You know, we're definitely not as polite a society as we used to be.
You mentioned earlier that your dad was pretty machismo. Did you, at the time when you went to South Carolina, did you, at any point, was it like, thought, am I just not my father?
Yeah, actually, that's become more of a prevalent thing the older and older that I've gotten. But there are some ways. Now, I was actually probably, if he were alive, he died when I was in the Navy.
Yeah, huh?
Yeah, I think the last time I saw him was a little bit after 9/11. He OD'd.
He OD'd on heroin?
Yeah, and crack. Two for one. Nice, yeah.
At least he probably didn't feel anything.
Yeah. And so he OD'd, and I think, like, if he were, I just pity him. And I think that by the time I was like 16, I was bigger. By the time I was like 14, I was his size. By the time I was 16, I was bigger. And, you know, you still kind of, because he was my dad, I was a little bit like afraid of him. But I think by the time I was like 22 or 23, I'd been like, Dad, I'll smack the shit out of you. Yeah. I was more afraid of my mom, because my mom actually raised me.
Right.
And it took a lot for my mother to raise I'm 6'4", 300 pounds now. I've always been, since I was a kid, the biggest kid. And it takes a lot to raise a big kid like that.
Right, because you probably may not realize it consciously, but everyone's a little bit scared of you.
Right. Oh, I'm very well aware of it now.
I'm petrified of you personally.
I'm sorry, man. I'm a big softie.
I usually sit a lot closer to my guests.
We are in a safety booth.
Yes. I usually don't put people in glass cages.
Yeah, no. But I am a monster.
So when's the last time you saw your dad? Do you remember the last moment?
I think we bought some CDs at a Best Buy. My grandma passed away, and he got a bunch of money in the estate, and he got not like oodles of money, maybe 40 or 50 grand and a car. And him and his stupid fuck wife shot it all up into their arms. And I remember seeing him like towards the end. I was like, I don't know how much longer you're going to make it, buddy.
You said that to him?
No, not really. I just wanted to have, like, we would hang out for like an afternoon, and I just wanted it to be over with. Mm-hmm. He never really had an interest in my life, and he never really wanted to like be present. I think he was just so wrapped up in self-loathing and self-pity that he just wanted to, I think he knew subconsciously what he was doing, just killing himself.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Who knows? But did he know that you knew that he was using?
No, I think I don't know. I don't think he knew.
Yeah, I think a lot of times junkies don't realize how obvious it is.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it was so obvious. Like, his eyes were jaundiced, and he was just misshapen. He was thinner in areas than he should have been, but fatter in areas where he shouldn't have been. And he died. His wife, my stepmother, had abandoned the kids.
Wait, they had kids.
They had two kids. Yeah, they weren't. They were, my sister at the time was 14, and I think my brother was 12. and they're in the house. He dies. He overdoses. She's all junked up. And so she takes a car and just takes off and leaves the kids with the dead body in the house. Yeah. For like days. And they, you know, so they
had, she didn't call the police or anything. Her husband dies.
Yeah. So yeah, the kids ended up having to like pretty much take care of all of it. And then the state was going to take them. And then their grandparents, her parents, intervened and took them in.
Well, she kind of had no choice because she's using as well.
Oh, she could have just been an adult and then owned up to the bullshit. They caught her. She ended up having to go to jail. And
you did have to go to jail.
Yeah,
you can't just leave the scene with a dead body, even though she didn't kill him.
Right. Yeah. There were so many counts that she was guilty of, you know, child endangerment, child abandonment, leaving a fucking corpse. Like that's a law, you know?
It is, huh?
Yeah. 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 You can't leave corpses around. And, who knows whatever else that she was fucking charged with.
So whose kids were those?
Her and my father's. Yeah, they're my half siblings.
Right.
So.
But they were her maternal children.
Yeah, they're her kids.
Left them.
Yeah, yeah.
Were they using when they were conceived?
No, she smoked though when they were. And yeah, the reason that my dad wasn't a junkie for the majority of the time that the kids were around, he didn't have any money to be.
That inheritance was a blessing and a big curse.
It was a huge curse. It was a huge curse. Yeah. And that's sometimes one of the things I worry about with my own self.
You have addictive tendencies?
Not like that, but I'm not always the best with money. Like if somebody gives me like a boatload of money, I'm like, oh shit, who wants some jet skis?
Right, right.
Like, and just like an inability to manage it. I've gotten so much better over the years. Actually being poor has really taught me that. Being a poor comedian has really taught me to stretch a dime.
Yeah. Which is a good lesson to learn.
Yeah. I used to be better. My mom was really, really good at it. My mom's excellent with her finances and she's really good at it. And she never really passed those lessons on to me. But from the moment I've been working since I was 15, I've never been good at saving, but I've been good at always making sure I pretty much have money to spend.
How did you, when you got back to South Carolina, how did you deal with kind of adjusting to regular civilian life and taming some of that machismo out of you?
It took a long time. It took like a good solid year. I lived with one of my best friends and his wife. And I remember sitting there. Just we would be at like a social function. Did you ever see The Hurt Locker? Catherine Bigelow movie. It's Jeremy Renner. He plays like a bomb. He plays a bomb technician over during that shit. At one point in time, he comes back home and he's with his wife from deployment. And he's in there's this one scene, I'll never forget it. And he's in the grocery store trying to live like a normal life. And right, that's right. Just box, he's in the cereal aisle and he's looking at all just the boxes of cereal and he's like, I don't understand this fucking world.
Right.
And now it wasn't that bad for me, but I do recall like being in grocery stores and looking at people and be like, this is completely fucking weird.
Right. Well, when you're in the military, there's a primal thing of like, you're fighting to survive. Everything is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you're in the grocery store aisle, I would imagine you're like, I don't care. Well,
yeah, life is set on easy.
It's meaningless.
It's meaningless. You can look at it and be like, all this sugar-coated crap is just sent out to be marketed to people.
Which can be pretty depressing.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially when you have been around the world and you see that other people don't live like Americans do. I mean, I went to the grocery store like anybody else when I was in the military, but I was I was just like the day-to-day. If like it was one thing to go to the grocery store once in a week if you're in the military and you see other military people and whatnot, and then you know that you're still in that mindset, but to have that release,
right,
and then to just be like, I'm a normal person now.
Yes,
that took a lot of readjustment.
Yeah.
And I didn't even see, I saw combat, but I didn't even see like combat. Like combat where you, like these guys who are boots on the ground kicking in the door. I can only imagine what that feels like.
It must be even that much harder to adjust than what you had to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wasn't good at socializing with regular people. It took a long time for me to deal with that.
What was it? Just the small talk?
Small talk. When you're, I was gone a lot. So relationships with people and especially women were short and they were intense.
Right. There were no women on your boat. I mean,
no, there were women.
Oh, there were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you were, all right. You had some conversations.
Yeah,
with
Lots
the
of,
other half.
Lots of really great women I served with for sure. Cool. Totally cool people. But they even, they don't socialize how normal people socialize. And then also too, I was never good at it on my own anyways. I was always a weird outcast kid in high school, as it were. And then like briefly in college, I wasn't always the best at it. And then as I was starting to learn and develop those things, I take myself out of that situation. I put myself in a completely different set of circumstances. And so it was really a case of arrested development in that regard.
Yeah.
And then also it was arrested development, and then it turned into a different culture entirely.
Yeah.
So then it took about a year or so for me to really like find my groove and get back to being, or get to being like, just like a regular guy.
How old were you at the time in Charleston, South Carolina, where you started to get your groove and like assimilate?
26, 27.
Okay.
Yeah.
When did you move to New York?
33.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were there for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there for 7 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What made you start stand-up comedy?
I had always been funny. I always used to write.
Were you funny on the boat?
Yeah. I on our way back from Iraq, we had a talent contest, and we had a talent contest, and a whole bunch of people entered, and they'd enter to sing or play guitar or something like that. And people were like, "You should enter, you should enter," and I was like, "No, no, no, I'm not gonna enter," because I used to do impressions of everybody around the ship, and I used to just make fun of people all the time, or just like tell stories or do goofy shit. They're like, "Enter, man, enter, do your impressions of people, whatever." And I was like, "No, no, 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 I'm not gonna enter." And I didn't enter for a specific reason. This is how like much of a prick showman I am, is that, but I still went and watched, right? And so everybody that was telling me to enter, they were all also watching. And so there were like maybe 10 contestants or whatever. We had 300 people on the boat. There's like maybe 10 contestants, and they went up, and the captain's hosting it. And he was like, "Is there anybody else like who's left or whatever?" And then I knew it in the crowd, and they started a chant. They're like, "Hump, hump." That was my nickname. "Hump, hump, hump." I got the whole mess decks was like chanting for me. I was like, "I didn't even enter, guys." And like, you know, and then I just went up there and I was like, "All right, I guess I'll do my impressions." I did like a set.
Yep.
And I won.
Nice.
And I, you know, I got like time off or whatever, which is huge in the military. That's money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but I'd always been that way. I used to write sketches in school. I used to draw comics with my friends. I used to be the caught up in the classroom and the lunchroom and all that sort of shit. I just didn't know how to channel it properly.
Yeah.
And so when I got to Charleston, I went, just got a normal job. I was working at a hotel, and I would be involved in like rec league basketball and tennis and stuff, which was fulfilling. It was great for exercise, but it wasn't enough.
Right.
And Charleston didn't really have, they had a comedy club, but it closed. It was some type of like, you know, LOL level club, you know, and it closed,
which is a low level
club. Pretty low level. And so they had, but they did have, Charleston has a fantastic art scene, and they had an improv theater. And so I just Googled Charleston comedy. The improv theater came up. You could take classes. So I just started taking classes.
Did you know at the time if you wanted to do stand-up comedy, sketch comedy? You knew you wanted to do comedy of some sort?
I really wanted to do stand-up. I just didn't know how you did it.
Right.
And
had you listened to stand-up comedians at the time?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you didn't know how you go about getting into it?
Yeah, I just don't know. Yeah, I used to, when I lived in Toledo, when I was out on my own, 18, 19, 20, I would go to like the college had poetry readings, and you could do like,
you're like, okay, it's spoken this is word. It's
yeah, it's like I could get up on stage and I could tell stories, and I could like, I told like funny stories or do silly things or whatever the case may be. We had a comedy club, but I never put two and two together to just go by there and be like, hey, how do I get into this? I just thought it was just such an untangible. I didn't even think you just, because every comedian always came from another place. It's like, oh, you got to go somewhere else to be a comedian.
Right. It was mostly touring comics coming through.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we ever had a local comedy scene for sure. Yeah. So I moved to Charleston.
I'll bet there's one now.
There is one now. Yeah. One of the guys actually, I think he's moving here because it's done so well for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was in Charleston and I started taking improv classes. And that was a lot of fun, but it wasn't really quite like where I was trying to be at, sort of thing. And I met a guy, and then we started doing sketch. Me and a couple of people started doing sketch. And then I met a guy who had done stand-up before, and he was just getting back into it. And so he and I started doing stand-up. We started an open mic together. It was mainly him. He mainly ran with it. And then that guy just made his debut on The Tonight Show a couple of weeks ago.
Who is that?
Dusty Slay. Oh. Yeah, one of my good friends. And so we started doing stand-up together, and then it got to a point where Charleston's like a really nice town, and it's really quaint, and they'd like to have things be nice and neat and clean and pretty, and they don't want to deal with some of like the gritty underside of life. And I wanted to be in New York. I wanted to be like, we used to have this open mic, this place called the Upper Deck Tavern. And it was a second story bar, but you had to walk into like this alleyway looking fucking place with this dark red light. And you had to walk up a set of stairs, whatever. And just walking into that hallway, into the dark red light, going up, that was like my favorite thing in the world, because it was like, I felt like I was entering just this seedy underworld.
Yeah.
I read a lot of Hemingway and Henry Miller and stuff like that in my late teens and early 20s. And I just liked
edginess.
I love in New York, especially in Brooklyn, or, you know, even Manhattan, I love seeing a red sign outside a bar that just says bar.
Right.
You know, one of the ones that stick out into the street or whatever the case may be, or just like, because that's where real life happens in the shadows.
Yeah. You probably don't love the trend of New York then, because it's changing.
Yeah. It's getting too clean.
Very clean.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't really see drug dealing on the street, which is odd for a city. You don't see prostitution on the street.
No.
You don't see that much graffiti.
No. Mm-mm.
And those bar signs are now like yogurt signs.
Yeah, for 16 handles.
Yeah,
it is kind of sad in that regard. It's good, I guess, but then it's also crime. Bad. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there is definitely less crime, but then also though, but back then though, when that sort of shit was going on, people day to day looked proper. Like there were more, like, you know, people don't really wear suits and ties as much anymore.
Right.
Collared shirt. I mean, look at me. It's too hot for that sort of shit anyways. But like, but
yeah, you never saw those people sweating, you know,
like, I know, which is
the
weird.
Beat poets are walking around with a suit and whatever.
Yeah. But. Yeah. Yeah. Like Bret Easton Ellis in the '80s was running around the East Village in a suit. And I'm like,
yeah.
How'd you pull that off, man?
Yeah.
Not really, you know?
So how did it strike you? Because often improv and stand-up comedy are lumped together as just comedy, comedy. But once you get into it, you realize they're so different.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the people are so different.
Yeah.
Now, you coming from the Navy, getting into improv, you're used to that kind of camaraderie.
Yeah, a little bit.
In improv, you really rely on your teammates.
It's team sport.
It's a team sport.
Yeah.
Where stand-up comedy is very much alone.
Right. Exactly.
Very alone.
Yeah. Back to fighting that war alone.
Yeah. Yeah. But in the Navy, you probably felt like you weren't alone. You're fighting all together.
Right.
So did you like improv, feeling that teammate?
I did. I did like improv. The other aspect of it, though, was it was because it was a team. If you're the type of person who really wants to take comedy seriously, to make it a real pursuit, you need other people to have that same level of intensity.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And, you know, Charleston's a beautiful place, and some people are just happy to perform like once a week, you know, in front of their friends and local, you know, community, which I think is fantastic. I wish I were the type of person who could have been happy with that. And because I think that's a very happy life.
Yeah.
But I wasn't destined for happiness.
you feel like this creative thirst is a curse?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My wife and I wrestle with it all the time because my wife is super smart. She's a teacher in New York City. She teaches at Bard Early College. She works with students who have certain learning deficits, I guess we could call it. Mm-hmm. And she works with just like a select group of students. And I think that she helps them maintain, like they're really super good in, you know, 5 out of 6 areas. She helps them with the shortfall that they're in.
Right.
But they're also students who I think need, have a little bit challenges, like special needs. And she's been trained to deal with that. Which
how long you been married for?
2 years.
How long did you date before?
We dated for 4 years before that.
I asked because I'm newly married. It's actually day 18.
I know. Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. How long were you guys together before?
About a little more than 2 years.
Oh, okay. What does your wife do?
She's a musician and she's studying to become a SLP, speech language pathologist.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's what I think Racine's girlfriend does. That.
Mm.
Yeah. But anyways,
I wanted to ask you.
Oh, no, go on.
Just because it's new for me.
Yeah.
How did it change things, like going from girlfriend to wife?
No.
Anything changed for you?
No, I don't think so. I think, marriage makes it more real. You can't just walk away. Although we, you know, had instances where we both could have walked away before. But the reason our marriage works is that we would be completely fine if we weren't with each other. We're completely independent people.
Right.
Which is, in theory, sounds probably better than it really is. Because she had summers off. She was in Asia for most of the summer by herself.
Yeah, I saw that. She was gone for 2 months.
Yeah.
I didn't see her?
She, 2 months. Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I would say it was more like 6 weeks she was gone in Asia, and then she came back for about a week, and then she went down to South Carolina because her family, she has some family in South Carolina.
Mm.
And so I hadn't really seen her most of the summer. And I'm here, and I told her I couldn't take the summer off to not, you know, not only like working-wise. We could have subleased our apartment, and I could have just lived like, you know, with her in Asia or whatever, but I didn't want to take that time off of comedy because it's my job.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And thankfully, this summer I feel like I put a lot of work in and I feel like I've really progressed. So it wasn't for naught. However, it's not something that I really want to go through again. I don't want us to be separated that much.
Yeah. How was it? Was it a strain on the relationship?
No, I mean, she's happy. She's happy that she went. I'm happy for her that she went. Yeah. I wish I could have gone. I was like pretty envious of that. I think if I had stayed here and I just got drunk every day and fucked off, that would have been a real bad scenario. That definitely would have been the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think not that you guys sound codependent at all, but I think that kind of just happens. You get like a fear of separation. You get like separation anxiety. It's almost chemical.
Yeah. I trust her completely and she trusts me, which is huge.
Yeah.
That's the biggest aspect I've learned of any relationship.
Trust.
Trust. You got to have that 100%. And it can be difficult. It was difficult for her for a while, I feel like, to deal with me being in comedy.
Why? Because you're out at bars and stuff all the
time?
Yeah,
because I'm out a lot. And thankfully, I don't drink like I used to.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big contention for the two of us. And I never did anything bad. It's not like I was running around pulling my dick out, you know, sort of shit. Or even being a bad guy or saying anything bad. It was just more like the hangovers were starting to add up, and then like money. And I was more irritable than anything right. like that. But then also too, one misconception about comedy is that you have to be a drunk or you have to hang out and drink all the time. You can hang out. I love hanging out with comics. Oh. I just don't need to go get plastered with them every day.
Mm.
And that's a sad misconception that I think we could probably do away with.
I found that a lot of comics actually don't even drink.
More and more aren't drinking as much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God for weed.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
So was that was an issue with you and your wife? She didn't like that you were drinking a lot while you were dating? You were drinking a lot?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, and even when we were married initially, I was drinking. It was just a habit. It was just like every day it would be like at least like probably two beers, you know, or, mm-hmm. which isn't bad, but it's also not good.
Right. When it's 7 days a week.
When it's 7 days a week. And then like on the seventh day, you're drinking 12 beers. And yeah, it starts to become a real problem.
But you're not getting drunk on two beers.
No. Uh-uh.
Especially if you're drinking 7 days a week.
Right. Yeah. 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 But just like being out of shape and the lifestyle and looking shitty and I was, since I don't sleep, it made me more irritable.
Right.
But the first half of the year, the first 6 months of the year of this year, I didn't drink at all.
Took 6 months off.
I was trying to do the whole year, but we were out of town Memorial Day and we were having a really good weekend. I was like, I would like one beer. And now I have a beer every few days because doing comedy, sometimes you get all the free beer you want.
Yeah.
But I turn a lot of it down.
I'm of the philosophy that moderation is kind of more impressive than a hard line.
Absolutely. Yeah, and also too, I just don't want to be boring. Like I don't want to be the guy you can't yeah. I don't want to be the guy you can't like have a beer with because, you know, right. like I'm gonna be a fucking monster if I just have a beer. That's never the case.
Right. Well, you see people like 4 years sober. I'm like, whatever. I'm like more than that moderating, you know. Yeah.
Some people really need it. And I've seen some people who can't have just two beers. I get it, but
then moderate. That would be much more impressive than just being sober.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, if you can like handle the temptation but also indulge just a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. To be a normal freaking person.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I just have to have a beer though.
Yeah, I'm just half playing with it.
Yeah, half.
I'm moderating. That's my philosophy. You know, never all the way one way or the other.
Yeah.
I think the happy medium is right in the happy place.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, so I got involved in stand-up in Charleston. And mm-hmm. we started to get this little scene going. And there were a lot of us at the time who were doing comedy. And then it started to gain traction. And more stand-ups wanted to come through town, and we would get opportunities to open up for, you know, Michael Ian Black or Todd Barry or TJ Miller or whoever the case may be.
Yeah.
I got to stop telling people I opened up for him at this point, but,
You lost the credit. Damn it.
I wouldn't even call it that, but Rory Scovel was a huge sweetheart. Nate Bargatze.
Yeah.
They're all so great at just, They were all real honest. They were like, you gotta get out. You gotta leave Charleston at some
point. How many years were you doing it in Charleston for?
Four years, I think. 4 or 5 years, pretty solid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
5 years probably. But
I think that's the best though. Start somewhere else and then move to New York.
I should have gone to instead of doing 4 years, we'll say I did 4 years in Charleston, because cumulatively though, because I never got to experience a real club. Everything was always indie.
Right.
I never got to work with like a club manager or like some type of agent or anything like that. So a lot of professional, I missed out on a lot of professional skills. I wish I had gone to a city like Atlanta or Chicago or something like that for maybe a year or two, but right. I was 33. I wish I had moved at like 30 or 31 to like Chicago.
Yep.
And then gotten some time in there and then moved to here.
Right.
Because so I had a huge gap in experience and wherewithal that it's taken me now, like, what year is this? Yeah, like 5 years, 5-6 years to really close as much as I can.
What do you mean close?
Close the gap in terms of this is how comedy really works.
Right, right.
It's not like a theater system. It's not an indie system. There are, I mean, clubs are just bars with microphones. However, they do have a system about which they go things.
Yeah.
And, you know, also too, in Charleston's being such a small town, it's a lot easier to be a big fish in a small pond.
Right.
Yeah.
And also the quality of the work. Did you notice that? Because the quality here in New York, you're often doing shows with some of the top stand-up comics in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And must have been, was it a shock for you to come here and be like, whoa, that person's amazing?
Yeah, it was like really pretty cool. I mean, thankfully I'd come like maybe like once or twice before, and I'd gotten to be around some comics who were touring from New York, so I got to see what the real difference was. And it was pretty shocking. Like, I remember going to Christian Polanco used to run an open mic at Freddy's when I first came, and the people who used to go to that mic are like Michelle Wolf and like Noah Gardensworth and Adam Newman and Subha Agarwal, and like all people who are now on TV or writing for TV or who put out Comedy Central specials or roasted the president.
Yeah.
And I knew then, I was like, this is, these people are really good and this is really cool to be around.
Right.
And it forced me to step my game up.
Did you feel like some of your time in Charleston was wasted because you weren't pushed that much as far as your quality?
I wouldn't say wasted, because the theater had, I mainly worked with the theater, a Theater 99, and they had a quality that they wanted to put out. They were serious about their art, and I respect that. So force me to, I wanted to be the guy who could, like, you know, really be extreme, like, lack of a better. I was really like a Bill Hicks guy, but and address some of these things more. But it's like, you know, these are regular working class people who just want to take their mind off of stuff. You got to be, you know, so I had to be humbled in that sense. I used to hold a real chip on my shoulder, though, because I felt like I wasn't getting the respect that I was due. But that's really just
when you moved to New York.
No, when I was in Charleston. But that was just, that's more me. I think I was just born with that chip on my shoulder anyways. I just now finally gotten to the point in my life where I'm like, I got to chill the fuck out. And I wouldn't say wasted. I wouldn't say wasted in the arts, because participating in the arts is good at any level. I would say I wasted it on women, in the hopes of some of the relationships that I had turning into serious ones.
Right. Well, that's a learning experience as well.
That's a learning experience in life. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I'm glad that the relationships didn't turn into what I thought they were going to, or else I wouldn't be here now.
Right. They might have kept you there.
They would have kept me there. I'd probably have like a kid. I mean, not that that's bad, but it's just not what's in me.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing how fragile our life's paths are.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was one woman I was with. She wanted to move away to like a even smaller country town in the mountains. And I was like, I'll give up everything because I love you so much, sort of crap. Yeah. And then now looking back, I'm like, oh, fuck that.
Yeah. That might have been a romantic hope that would have.
Yeah. That was a real immature idea on my behalf, and I'm glad that it never materialized.
Yeah, I used to be kind of a stupidly romantic like that. You get older and you get more realistic.
Yeah. I tried to join the French Foreign Legion when I was in France while I was in the Navy because I fell in love with a chick.
Oh, man. What is the French Foreign Legion? What does that entail?
So we met a couple guys who were in it. It's always a thing that I had known about since I was a kid through like cartoons and shit, especially like Bugs Bunny for whatever reason.
Pepe Le Pew?
I just associated with that. And it was like, France isn't necessarily known for their military might. So I think they outsource some of it to whoever's willing to do it in exchange for citizenship. And I was in lust with a girl so much that we're in France after 9/11. We were in France and we're supposed to be there for like 3 days. We ended up being there for 10 because there were always storms that were coming and we just couldn't get out of the port. So me and a couple of buddies ended up hanging out with these girls the whole time and they would, you know, take care of us. And like, they're like, stay.
They spoke English.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And they're like, stay we'll take care of you and you can go to school here and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, this is awesome.
I mean, you must have been kind of a rock star. You're an American and you were in the Navy.
Yeah. And I was in good shape for once.
Is that a thing? Do you find that when you pull up in port and you go out in the world, are women like,
No, not always. No. In fact, more often than not in France, they weren't into it. We weren't in uniform. And we ended up hanging out at this bar called the Blind Pig. And that's just this one we ended up at the most. And that's where we met these girls. And just after hanging out with them for a few days and then them like taking us in basically is how that kind of developed. Yeah. But for the most part though, especially after 9/11, definitely after Iraq, when you pull in somewhere, you are not a rock star.
Yeah. Probably. Not welcome.
No, not at all. Except for Boston. We went to Boston the first 4th of July after 9/11 for Fleet Week there. And that was like being a rock star. You know, people buy you drinks. We go out to the club. I was like 22. My buddy Mike Bongiorno was like 19. And like the bouncers would look at it, his ID, and they'd look at his uniform like, come on in, man. Yeah.
You think some of that drinking was to deal with any sort of PTSD or stuff you were working out?
No. Substance abuse runs on both sides of my family.
That's okay.
Yeah. Everybody on my father's side of the family, with the exception of my aunt, had passed away due to substance abuse.
Mm.
My sister, my uncle, my father, grandparents, like,
wow.
They're all just like either alcohol or drugs. Like my uncle, my father, and my sister all died because of OD. And my mother's side, everybody, not everybody, but there's a fair amount of alcoholism, which I think is somewhat cultural.
Yeah.
Why am I having such a hard time speaking right now? It was either that or somewhat biological, chemical.
Well, I imagine the heroin's not cultural.
No, that was just a dark need. Mm-hmm. I don't like drugs. I used to do... like chemical drugs. I don't like pills. I don't like acid. I don't like anything you shoot or snort or ingest in that way. I did a little bit when I was like 19. I was like, I don't give a fuck. I want to be a rock star sort of shit. But then like around like 2021, I'm like, I don't want to do any of that.
What were you just experimenting? I mean, most 19.
Yeah. Like 20. I took like a lot of acid. I concluded my experiments, and the experiment was don't do acid ever again.
Weren't you in the Navy at 2021?
No, I didn't join the Navy. I was 21 when I joined.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't want to be on acid in the Navy.
No. In fact, the last time I had done mushrooms, I had done it with my buddy Jim, and I ate like a half ounce of mushrooms.
Half an ounce?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that was the night, and everything went bad. And that the next day, I was like, all right, I'm definitely joining the Navy.
And the next day after that,
I was like, I knew I went to their office like I didn't go immediately the next day because I wanted to like shake off some of the.
Yeah. Did you realize that the dosage of a half an ounce of mushrooms is like way, way, way too much?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I found that out. Yeah, I knew it. Like, well, going into it, I had been doing like an eighth at a time, and I was like, well,
still a lot.
Yeah, I was like, no, this is going to be the blowout one. And it sure as shit was.
Did you see stuff?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I couldn't see normally.
Right.
And I tried to drive.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you able to?
No. I pulled my car over and I parked it in some empty parking lot in a suburb of Toledo.
Were you in touch with your conscious mind at all?
No, barely. Barely.
That voice that tells us, hey, you're too this or too that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. Enough to know that I shouldn't drive.
So that voice was still there. You couldn't silence it with a half an ounce of mushrooms.
No. I mean, I just, like, the thing was, is I'm trying to drive, and the road is moving. And I just know that. I just at least had presence of mind to know that if I get arrested or if I get pulled over, I'm fucked. I'd already been arrested once on acid. So I knew, like, I'm done.
And they'd be able to tell you were tripping.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My pupils. I mean, you couldn't see the blue in my eyes. and I just didn't want to fuck with that. And I just knew at that point, I was like, my life is going nowhere. If this is really where I'm at and this is what I'm going for, then, like, what the fuck am I really doing with myself?
That was your bottom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, more or less in that regard. Yeah.
Yeah. See, there's something good about that.
Yeah. 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 And sometimes every now and again, though, like properly, mushrooms are supposed to, like, help you.
Right.
And now sometimes I kind of think about that because I get depressed like everybody else. And people are like, well, I read where I took mushrooms and then, like, it completely rearranged where I was and all that. And I'm like, I still don't want to fuck with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd rather just try and, like, maybe meditate, or I've gotten into yoga. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So
people do ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca. Yeah. Yeah. Screw all that. Yeah. I don't know. I've seen the other side. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah. Half an ounce of mushrooms, I'd say. Yeah.
I think people need, if they go through guided levels of that sort of stuff.
I think that's the big difference with drug users, is that some people do drugs to escape that voice.
Yeah.
They want to lose control.
Yeah.
You know, where if you're not liking the fact that you lose control, that's probably a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you seem like someone that wants to stay.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, that's the thing with the drinking thing too. Is my wife, when we were having some of our discussions about the level of alcohol that I was using, was that my argument was always like, when do you ever see me wasted? I was like, you never see me wasted or whatever. And she's like, well, you get a little loud or whatever the case may be. And I was like, well, usually people after 8 beers are fighting people, so right. It was like, in comparison then, which is still a dumb argument.
Yeah.
Yeah,
comparing yourself to the worst possible scenario.
For the most part, whenever now after having taken 6 months off of drinking, now I do notice when I do have 2 beers, I'm like, okay, that's my limit.
But you get jovial, right?
It's but I don't shut up at the appropriate time sometimes.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Man, what a story.
Oh, thank you.
What a story. So I saw your website, DerekHumphrey.com.
Yeah, DerekHumphrey.com.
You have a ton of shows coming up.
I have some shows coming up. I don't know when this airs, but you know what? If anybody listens to this and they really want to come out and see a show, I promise you I'm way more funnier on stage than I am right in this moment talking about all my bullshit. I on October 17th, I'll be at Gotham Comedy Club for a benefit for veterans. Joe List is headlining, and I'll be there. I don't know if anybody else or who else is going to be there, but it's going to be a great show. Tickets, I think, should be going on sale soon. But then, I'm at my show, Bushwick Bears, every Sunday at Mad Tropical.
Some videos of you online.
There are some videos of me online. Yeah,
there's links in the show notes as usual.
Oh, thanks, man. And then I got a sketch coming out next week with Boris Hyken and Sarah Dooley.
Cool.
And I think it's gonna be pretty funny. So
awesome, man. Thanks for sharing your life.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. This is cool.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.